Welcome to the podcast Cultural Change. Great that you're here. This is Marco Schaper, and as usual, I have a wonderful guest with me today. That's Annemie Ress. Hello, Annemie.
Hi. Hi, Marco. It's lovely to be here.
Great to have you on the show. So the topic of today is something that we all were thinking about probably for quite some long time. Whenever you have any change in your company, in your organization, and so on, how do you make sure that it really starts and happens on the individual level? So the topic is change is you. You are change, and the change always starts on the individual level. And this seems to be very intuitive as a topic, because of course people need to change, and the difficulty though is if you've ever done it for an organization of hundreds or thousands of people, that is very difficult to do. So we want to explore a little bit, how does it work, and what are the hints maybe for practitioners to make it work well. And for that we have Annemie Ress here. Hello again, and Annemie, maybe can you say a few words on yourself, who you are, what you are, why you are the way you are.
Well, that's a whole different podcast, right?
indeed.
So, yes, I'm Annemie. I'm South African. I live in London at the moment, and I love change. I've had a very, very diverse background, from being a lawyer and, studying human rights law to working for a human rights organizations, to working on a trading floor in the City of London, to spending some time in the corporate world, working in employment and strike negotiation and trade union relations, to working, where we met at RWE Energy, in the investment and energy space, and also above all, set up my own business called Purple Beach, which is really focused. It's a consultancy focused on business model innovation. But at its core, we acknowledge that it starts with people and people innovation. So that's why, my career is very varied. I love change. And what I want to do every day is actually work on what you say there, because, the hopeful message for me is actually, if we can crack this individual change topic, we can make so much more of a difference than rather than rolling out big transformation programs. And you know how likely they are to fail, right? These big, expensive corporate programs.
Oh, yes. And it's maybe fair to say that Annemie and myself, we've worked together at InnoG when, this new company was created, and we tried really to establish a new culture from day one, more or less. And I must say, this was one of the most intriguing initiatives that I ever was part of. And, I'm a technician, so I'm a software guy. I'm usually more inclined towards analytical stuff and all that things. But this was really a program that touched my heart. And let's explore a little bit about that, how you've designed it, why you've designed it the way you've designed it, and what worked well and what worked not so well. But before we do that, I mean, your CV is very colorful, if I may say so. What was for you personally the biggest change, and what was the trigger for that? Do you want to share with us?
So I think it's interesting. You would have heard there that I said I wanted to be a human rights lawyer. I wanted to change the world. I believed I worked for the new government in South Africa when all of those changes happened. And the hard lesson I learned is that actually, that's not where I can have the biggest impact or drive the biggest change. And so for me, getting that realization, actually working in the corporate world, where I thought you can have a much more immediate and quicker impact on people, was a change that I struggled with, because it felt like I was giving up on my values. But actually I wasn't, because imagine applying, I think, the values that we can apply in a human rights context, applying some of those basic principles to how we treat each other in the work context, can actually make for better organizations, better leaders, and better systems and better outcomes for people. So I think that was the biggest change, actually deciding I'm not going to be a human rights lawyer, but I still am going, I don't know what's going to happen. I'm just going to embrace the journey and actually switch to the corporate world.
And what triggered this decision?
Well, ironically, unfortunately, I think it was that I saw, that political agendas, as idealistic as they are, more often than not, can only very slowly impact on people's lives and in a very limited way. I also saw that politicians are politicians, and this is my perspective, right? And so, I guess I became a little bit disillusioned with the pace of change, which is why I now am so passionate about driving pace at change in the corporate world.
Yeah, it's. I read the book of Nelson Mandela, the biography.
Long Walk to Freedom.
Mm-hmm. Yes, and I was intrigued by, especially the early days, when this was literally a fight, a physical fight, yeah. A military fight. Yeah. And I was surprised how rational the decision was to go into that fight, rather than to take emotions and use hatred or whatever to stir up people and let them get to the weapons. He was thinking about, okay, the political way is far too slow and maybe it's not even working at all. So we have to find a military way, yeah. A brutal way. And somehow I was shocked by this openness, first of all. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're talking about a Nobel Prize winner for peace, right?
but then he was able to change, wasn't
yes.
he? And let
yes.
go and able to say, I'm now putting that behind me. So that was another big change.
Yes. And this is the funny thing about the personal change, right? In this case, Nelson Mandela's personal change also led to a state change of, a whole people in South Africa. So this is really fascinating indeed. Now, we're not talking about the biggest changes in the world now. We're talking about the smaller changes, but still organizations that have a lot of different people in there with a lot of different backgrounds. And the nasty question is always, if you want to do the right things into a certain direction, how do you really touch everyone? And usually we start this podcast with three questions for you, very simple questions.
Mm-hmm.
The first one, very simple. How often did you use the word change during the last working week?
Last working week, oh my goodness, at least 10 times a day.
Is it a bit overused?
Never.
Never. No, everything has changed. That's right. Okay, fine. The second question. What's your first thought when you come and hear the word an organizational change program and we need your help, Annemie?
Until you said we need your help, Annemie, and I'm really not being arrogant, when I hear organizational change program, I sigh inside, right? Because but then you said need help, and I think that fills me with hope, because I think organizations that are willing to take help and really innovate around how they drive change and are open for possibility and not wanting standard types of programs, methodology, infrastructure, project management can be same, but that's what I would say is more inspiring than what I think of when I think about change, organizational change. And I never use the word program because I think it doesn't have a beginning and an end.
Yeah,
for me in a corporate, it's always there.
And I think the sighing part I can very well understand, because whenever you hear this word program, it sounds like, first of all, it's included in itself, right?
Yeah.
It seems to be
exactly.
Like we do this change for the for as a self purpose, that cannot work, right? We all know that.
We've done the
boss. Yeah, exactly. Oh, we've done this change team here. It's eight people, and they're doing the change, afterwards
exactly.
Everyone is acting differently. Yeah, and we know it's not working like that. Now, the interesting bit is, of course, when I ask the second part of the question, and what would you do it and how would you do it, we come to that later on. But one of the things that usually happens before this organizational change programs are getting carved out somewhere is that we have business leaders coming to the conclusion, at least, they need an organizational change program. The one wish that you'd have for every business leader, what would that be?
That as they embark on any change journey, they're open to acknowledging they don't know what they don't know, and to truly embrace the unknown as an opportunity to drive real and sustainable change.
Well, and I need to think about it.
Yeah, because it goes back to that comment I made about program.
Yeah.
So if leaders go in and they say, yeah, we need to change and we want a program and come and help us make a program, it's kind of, they have a little bit of a preconceived idea, right? Number one, they're thinking program. Mm-hmm. Number, you know what I'm saying? Again, I feel I'm in the box. Whereas I think if they're open to not knowing what they don't know, I think that openness creates much more possibility and option and the willingness to experiment and explore. And also, like I said earlier, an acceptance that the change journey might not have a beginning and an end. It might have phases, or it might be a multi-year journey that we go on. But if you're really running a business as a leader, change, particularly now, needs to be part of the DNA of any successful company.
Yeah, that's a very, very deep statement in the sense that I can relate to it. When we had our first session, after Innogy was taken over by another company, mm-hmm. two worlds or two cultures collided somehow. Mm-hmm. And you would not really understand why these two companies were so different, despite the fact that they were working in the same industry. Both were relatively successful, similar size. Why would you expect, such a difference in culture? But there was, on the mm-hmm. very individual level. And I must say, I still do not understand really why this was happening. I just observed it. And of course, the moment when you observe it, you have the feeling, oh my God, what do I do now with it? I know my culture, kind of what I did in the past. I have no clue what this other thing is. It's somehow strange. It's different. It's visible. It's observable. So that's a good thing about it. And as you say, we started to experiment with it. We started mm-hmm. to bring components of one into the other and vice versa. But the funny thing is, and that's probably worth another mm-hmm. podcast in itself, integration of two cultures is never easy and usually never leads to one really new culture. I would rather say my hypothesis is one culture is the dominant one and will mm-hmm. take over the other, and you will lose a lot of the stuff that was happening in the other one. But that has to do more with how we do the cultural change and how we do the integration work. Let's now first maybe start with the simplest, quote unquote, thing about the normal change in an organization that doesn't go through a super large change in itself, but that maybe just wants to become a bit faster, a bit more agile, a bit more quality oriented, a bit more socially engaged or whatsoever. And usually we start with ourselves, right, with the leaders. What would be your hint for a leader how to really become a good role model?
I think it's about not seeing change as a thing that is done, but seeing change as a thing that you live. And let me give you a really practical example, right? Mm-hmm. So if I see change as a thing that is being done, I can put it away. It's not part of me. I can play at doing it authentically. It's a chore on my to-do list. Whereas if I live change, and this is again where the mindset topic comes in, in every day when I'm confronted, even with a basic change, if I'm conscious about what I'm seeing, what I'm thinking, what I'm feeling, and in consequence, how I act in relation to the change. I think that is, and that's the cornerstones of a mindset, right? If you have this mindset that consistently says, what am I in this moment where I'm trying to drive this change? What am I thinking? Okay, I'm thinking this, but what am I seeing? Mm-hmm. What am I feeling about what I'm trying to do here? Okay, now that I've got clarity on those things, what do I need to do, acknowledging that my thoughts, my feeling, and what I see might have a negative or positive impact? I have a choice. on how I then respond and what I do in relation to the change. So I think the one is doing it again as a to-do, and the other is just embracing this mindset with those four cornerstones. But you've equally mentioned to me just now, you've also been reading about the brain, right? And how, you know, the role of our brain in the context of change and what will work and what will not work. I'm not sure, my model's definitely not the same, but I often, where I see it work well is where I see leaders being really sensitive to thinking, feeling, seeing, and then doing.
Yeah, absolutely. And I can relate to that very well, both to the to-do list item topic, yeah. As well as to the living it really. The funny thing is living it really is much more energy consuming.
It's hard.
Maybe not time, really hard. Not necessarily time consuming, but energy consuming.
No, I agree.
I mean, the few moments when I really, you know, get into sweaty situations with myself was in a situation where I was really, you know, I was change. I was, you know, representing the change as a person, as really a human being, rather than just talking about it, giving a presentation about it, or, you know, reading out some prepared text about it. There was one situation that I maybe can share and see whether it fits to your view. When we did a strategy and an IT strategy for one of the companies I was working for, we crafted all that and had a lot of good thinking. And then at the end of the day, we created a newspaper that was kind of 5 years ahead, looking back. So what was happening throughout the last 5 years, and why was it a success? And we thought this is a nice, you know, emotional way to attract people. We are all still on this kind of to-do level logic, right? So we thought about, okay, we give it out to the people, they read it, and they will feel emotionally touched. Mm-hmm. Well, what you can imagine is they didn't. So we decided to do really sessions with teams, relatively smaller teams, not kind of town halls, but like 20 people, 15 people, and so on, where you can really get into a discussion. And I was asked, Marcus, can you, from your perspective, can you explain, you know, how it will look like in 5 years from now and what you've been gone through and so on? And that was a very clever question by one of the persons, because I was just doing that now. And while talking, I lived through this change myself in not only in theory or in analytical terms, but also in emotions. And I was really getting touched by this. And I think some people have seen some, you know, shimmer in my eyes. I was told afterwards that this was one of the most authentic meetings that they ever had with anyone.
Yeah, because you were feeling, you were seeing what was needed in the moment. Yes, obviously you were thinking because you had the content topic, and then you did. But you chose to do authentically as opposed to just keeping on doing the tick box, right? Because we all have a choice in that moment.
That makes you extremely vulnerable, isn't it?
Yeah. It's hard. Super hard. I'm not talking from a place of strength, I'm telling you. I've been on there as well and got it wrong sometimes. And hopefully most of the time's right, but wrong many times.
And this is maybe what the difficulty with many leaders is. People expect strength from leaders. And not vulnerability and weakness.
Yeah, but I think vulnerability. Someone actually, it's very interesting. You, the second person this week that said to me that comment, right? That people expect strength from leaders, not vulnerability and weakness. And I actually think it requires much more strength to be vulnerable, ironically. And it's by far to show your weakness requires bravery. It requires a deep level of comfort with who you are as a person. So I actually think that's much harder to do. It's easy to be blusterous or whatever the word. I don't even know what the word is in English. But
yeah, it is. And I can, again, I can relate to that because it made me really sweat. Literally.
That's your body telling you, right?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the body is a great source of feedback to that extent. Okay. If you've learned to listen to it. I needed to really learn it the hard way because my body was telling me, giving me cues, and I was never listening to them.
But we're not taught to do that. No one teaches you in school.
No, you indeed. Indeed.
We're taught to give the right answers from a young age. Okay, it's evolving now. Maybe I'm giving away our generation, but it is changing. And actually, you know, children in school, I don't know in Germany, but certainly in the UK, they're now learning about mindfulness. They're also learning about these things. But I think, you know, for us who are a little bit older, we were not taught that, right? Or taught that way.
Yeah, absolutely. And still we need to be role models, right? That's the exactly. The nasty bit of it. The good thing is some people or quite a few people are getting closer mm-hmm. to this kind of situation and understand it better. And the notion of mindfulness and so on, that was quite a striking argument or a striking experience. So in our joint leadership journey, that we joined it together at Innogy, one of the things that was most appealing to me was this notion of mindfulness. And I just wonder, as you were one of the designers of this program, how did you think about that? Why did you weave that into an organizational culture where this has had no place at all?
Yeah, it's interesting. I think it's you know, I think at its core, many people confuse mindfulness with mindlessness. But where I've seen mindfulness being truly present, whether it is in a conversation, you know, in a moment, I've just seen how that can drive such transformation that for me it's almost a no-brainer. And you know, I think also, again, coming to this notion of programs, right? Mindfulness doesn't need to be, okay, I'm going to be mindful for 10 minutes and I'm just going to sit here. It can be, I mean, as you know, it can be, look, I'm just going to take a couple of breaths just to reconnect with where I am. And I think in today's world, we are so mindlessly racing through lists and chores and things to do. But where I've seen true transformation happen is if we just pause and we're just really in the moment or in the conversation, the insights that emerge are phenomenal. And, you know, there's a really interesting book that I was looking while reading over the holidays called 4,000 Weeks by a gentleman called Oliver Berkman. And 4,000 weeks is the average amount of weeks we all live. And so in this book, he talks about the fact that if you know you've got your 4,000 weeks and you can go on the website and put in your age and then you say, oh, Sherbet, how many of my 4,000 weeks have I used? That gives you a good shake up because in that book, one of the things he talks about is mindfully choosing what you want to focus on. Mm-hmm. And then being mindful when you work on it. And anyway, so that's just an aside. But I mean, it's a powerful, powerful, really powerful intervention. And it's hard and it's not if you start small.
Yeah, that was my question because, you know, you have so, as you say, we have so many to-dos on our list. And usually you don't find anything like be mindful or even if you would find it, it would probably be meaningless because you can't just, you know, tick it off. Mm-hmm. Do you have any idea or any hint for us how to make it part of our daily practice if it's not coming automatically?
Yeah, I think it's about starting small and experimenting and finding something that works for you. So for some people, Headspace works, right? Which is an app and it talks you through mindfulness and it starts with 1 minute, then 2 minutes, then, you know, over time it goes longer. That works for some people. Doesn't work for me, but it is a wonderful, wonderful tool if that kind of approach works for you, where you listen to someone. Another approach, what I always say is breathing. Just take the how you can slow your body. If you take 30 seconds, 60 seconds of just closing your eyes and breathing, I've done that on many conference calls, it makes such a difference. It just grounds you again, brings you into the moment. Or, you know, I just before this session, I've decided to go back and listen to vinyl records. So just before this session, I just put on a record and I was just preparing for the session and I literally just listened to 3 songs. So that's that. Or after this session, now in 10 minutes, I have a drumming lesson. And I know, again, I'm not saying that I'm old, but later in life I started, I'm going to do I've done other instruments. I want to do drumming. So something that's so difficult that actually takes your mind away from all the other things you think about, that you can just be in that flow, is also, you know, another one. But the easiest one is just breathe.
Hmm.
We all don't breathe properly, right?
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And even if we talk, we don't breathe meaningfully. And that makes us short breath. Actually, I was going with my dog just before this session. So
a walk with your dog. They say touch your a pet or
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Now, we talked about starting with a change as a role model with the leaders. Now, the leaders is a limited amount of people, usually in a larger organization, yeah, maybe a few dozens or a few hundred. But then we're talking about thousands that we want to somehow touch, where we want to also see change in their behavior and their thinking and so on. Why is it so difficult to reach these thousands of people?
Yeah, because we follow standard one size fits all approach. One-size-fits-all approaches. If we work with customers, you talk to your customers and you understand what works for them and not, right? And that's why I'm a great believer when it comes to rolling out more broader change programs, to really understand your customer, just as you would understand your commercial customer, right? And not treat everybody the same. Help them to help you, do co-creation. You know, although there's so many options.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I was just also reading a book myself about how the brain works, as you alluded to earlier. And what was interesting to me is that the brain actually is not really about thinking so much or about feeling, but the brain is there to balance your budgets in the body, the energy budget, the sleep budget, the food budget. And as long as this is in balance, everything's fine.
I like that, and
I like that as well, because I thought, okay, there's somewhere a brain, there's an analytical side of the brain, and there's an emotional side, and there's the soul, and there's this and that. No, it isn't. The brain is just one thing. Of course, there are areas that are more linked to analytical thinking, more linked to emotional thing, but it's always happening everything at a time, at the same time. Mm-hmm. So also one of my misconceptions of the past was to think about, okay, let's give the people something more analytical. They can read and they can understand and they can allude to. And then let's have some more emotional things like parties and, fun things and so on. But it's not working like that, right?
No. And that comes, that's why I have such a huge amount of passion about innovating around change programs as well, to bring exactly those elements you say there, the analytical and the creative. And that's how I think, that's how you really make great things happen, by bringing the super analytical and the creative together.
Mm-hmm. And we use a little bit gamification for that, because gamification is actually not preoccupied. So you don't know how it will work out, right? Normally, if you go to a meeting, you know what will happen. If you go to a design workshop, you know what will happen and so on. If you go play a game, that is still so unusual, although you've done it as a child hundreds of times. But as a professional person, you don't expect games to be happening in professional life. And that's the good news about it. You get some fresh mind and open minds.
Yeah.
And the bit that I read from this book, 7.5 Lessons About the Brain from Lisa Feldman Barrett, a very good book, very good reading, was that the brain is making predictions about all your activities that you're doing. And the predictions are about, will my budget be still balanced? And as long as the answer is yes, you can continue with the way you work. The funny thing is, we want change, right? We want to have the people act differently. So that means we need to falsify the predictions of our brains.
Interesting.
Right? Mm-hmm. Which is a thought that is a very deep one, because usually people just see whatever change programs are happening and they realize, well, do I have to change anything? Well, as long as I can come and do my work and have fun as I did in the past, I don't.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to falsify this. We need to touch the people where they work and give them something like a surprise or even a shock or something.
Agreed.
Yeah, they're coming on Monday and they expect the Monday to be a Monday, but all of a sudden it is a wonder day. It's a different day, right?
I agree. I fully agree. I agree. And that's how you create memories, how you create anchor points, how you create associations. Agree.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And this is something still, of course, it's very difficult to falsify, you know, the predictions of hundreds or thousands of people at the same time. But role modeling could be one thing, because as a leader, you get watched all the time, right? If you start acting visibly differently all of a sudden, people realize, he's not the same guy anymore.
Yeah, and I think one of the things that I've often done when trying to drive change is not even talk about the change, but get the leaders to do the change, to start behaving differently. And then maybe 4 or 5 weeks into a change, you bring the team together and you say, what have you noticed over the last few weeks? Because then they can't say, oh, we don't believe the change will happen, because they'll never do it. So it's, you flip the whole idea.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. That is, I use it for almost like a trick when 5 years ago I wanted to have more agile coaches in my organization, mm-hmm. internal agile coach. So I wanted to have our people become agile coaches. And I gave this kind of usual town hall meeting where I said, well, we need to be more agile and agile coach, and you can get an agile coach training and everything, and we pay for it, and, you know, off you go. And then after some weeks, 2 or 3 people went, and I thought about more, 100. Yeah. So the next thing I said, I'll do it. I'll do it myself. Yes. Because I cannot expect it from you if I am not willing to do it myself. Yeah, yeah. And I invited quite a few opinion leaders from the different organizational levels to just accompany me in the course. And they did. And the notion that this brought was two things. One is, the leader is doing it himself. Rather than just talking about it. And the second one is, he's taking the people with him. And one of the other things I was doing, and again, it was a small trick, everyone who sent in the certificate of a Scrum Master would get a session with me, a coaching session, where I would congratulate and give some hints and give a small gimmick, a Scrum poker with an energy logo on it and things like that. And this was already, you know, enough of a change in prediction, because normally you would predict, well, the leaders tell me what to do, I need to do it then, and nothing happens afterwards.
Exactly.
And it was wrong, because, you know, you got your you got your cards, you got your session, you got a personal meeting and so on. And I think it wasn't because of me personally doing that, but because the brain all of a sudden realized, something has changed here. It is not the way I predicted.
Totally true. Totally. I love that example. I really like it.
Maybe let's get to the closing section. So it was great talking to you. If you think back, what is the key insights or any surprise that you took out of the podcast today?
I loved the book that you introduced us to, and this notion that our brain is constantly balancing, and therefore we need to make it or help it to do what it needs to do. And I think that's where mindfulness can be helpful.
That's a great insight. And also for me, the insight was really to start more and more being on this mindfulness trip and using some of the tricks that you mentioned, breathing, and also just thinking about where do we stand right now, what's happening now, and reacting to that authentically. That made a big difference to me today. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
So what's the one word that is in your head right now?
Afraid, because I didn't do my drumming practice. I'm going to be cross. No, I'm just kidding. No, I really, joy. This was really great. Thank you.
Joy and afraidness at the same time. What else do we want? Thanks a lot, Annemie. This was a great podcast. Thank you.
Thank you.